Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the IC Interviews podcast. I'm Dave Baxter, I'm the funds editor on the IC, and today I'm joined by Ian Lance, one of the portfolio managers on the Temple Bar Investment Trust. That's a UK income fund, has a value remit, and has seen something of a return to form under the current team in recent years. The team tends to focus on undervalued shares, but also they have been a big advocate of the concept of the UK itself being somewhat underpriced. Ian, thanks for coming on. How are you doing?
Yeah, very good, Dave. Nice to be here.
So let's jump straight into the UK debate, because that is something you've been pretty vocal on over time. Firstly, you know, this is the perennial question, but is there really a catalyst for a UK re-rating, or is it simply a kind of cheap forever type story?
Yeah, I think that's a really good place to start, because probably every UK equity fund manager has had a chart in their presentation for the last couple of years showing how cheap the UK equity market is, you know, and it hasn't really changed, has it? It hasn't really re-rated. And so people are absolutely right to ask us the question, you know, that's great, but what is going to cause the re-rating? And actually now I think there are two things that we can identify. The first one is that valuations of UK equities have got so cheap that it's attracted interest from overseas corporate buyers. So over the last decade, on average, there's been about 40 bids per annum of UK stocks. Last year, it was 65. And this year, it stepped up again. So I think overseas, you know, corporate buyers just can't believe the valuations of some of these UK equities, and they are taking advantage of it. That's point number one. Point number two is the companies themselves buying back their own stock. We have seen a massive step up in companies buying back their own stock. So about 50% of UK companies have bought back their own stock in the last year. That is a huge step up on previous years, and it's now the highest of any market in the world. So UK companies are buying back their own stock at a faster rate than any other company in the world. And we think that those two things will start to drive a re-rating to the UK market.
It's interesting. Obviously, as you mentioned, buybacks have been hugely topical, and it's now, you know, going at a very kind of prolific rate. But it does bring up those kind of questions about capital allocation policies of companies. And for example, yeah, one of our columnists recently was suggesting that, you know, various companies could actually cut their dividends in order to buy back shares and take advantage of that.
This is a difficult one, because in theory, whoever was writing that is absolutely right, is that when your shares are very, very lowly valued, you know, the theory will tell you you should cut your dividend to zero and you should just concentrate on the share buyback. Unfortunately, there's then the reality of what happens. And the reality of what happens is you move your dividend to zero, and basically a whole swathe of income funds immediately dump your stock. You know, we wouldn't, but I know lots of other people who would. And so in reality, I think companies need to have a balance of the two. A lot of people will know that the sort of probably the poster child for efficient capital allocation in terms of this is Simon Walson at Next. Now, what he does is he's always paid an ordinary dividend. When the shares are very low, he switches on the share buybacks. When the share price goes up and the share price and buybacks don't make so much sense, he switches on a special dividend. So he balances it between specials and ordinary dividends. And I think that's probably the right way to think about it.
So would you be expecting generally companies to be a bit more proactive on this front, a bit more dynamic perhaps?
Yeah, very much so. For the last couple of years, you know, we've been meeting with the CEOs, and they are, by and large, they are very frustrated people today, because you know, a lot of them feel like they've done really well in terms of running the business, and yet, you know, they've seen their share prices just go down and down and down. And we've said to a lot of these people, look, don't take it personally, and don't get frustrated about it. Use it to your own advantage, because when your shares are that lowly rated, there aren't many things which can produce value to your shareholders better than a share buyback. So, and as I say, it looks like that message has really started to get through to companies.
And what's, I mean, I guess you could argue, you know, huge part of the market looks cheap by certain metrics, but what are the sectors or perhaps individual companies at the minute that are actually kind of catching your eye, you know, and how do those names actually stand out at a time when, you know, valuations are broadly so depressed?
Yeah. Okay. So of the companies we own, the areas that stand out are, in terms of doing this, are energy, banks and insurers at the moment, but, you know, but there are others. So, you know, let me just give you some sort of interesting facts here. If I look at the energy companies, so the likes of BP have believe it or not, they generated over 40% of their market cap in earnings in the last 2 years, nearly half of their market cap in earnings in 2 years. Incredible. They bought back about 17% of their stock. And then you add on the dividends, you've had about 25% of the market cap back in dividends and share buybacks in 2 years. So that's the energy sector. The banks, some of the banks in particular, are even more significant than that. The one here which really stands out is NatWest. So NatWest have paid you back 14% of your market cap in dividends, but they've bought back 30% of their shares in 2 years. I mean, that is just an extraordinary figure. You know, imagine if that carries on at that sort of rate. So you've had 43% of the market cap back in dividends and share buybacks in just 2 years. And as I say, you know, insurance companies, similar sort of thing. And of course, it's logical that it should be those areas, because we think those areas are some of the lowest valued sectors in the market today. And therefore, it's logical that those should be the people who are using share buybacks.
Mm. It's interesting that you kind of mentioned energy. You've got a lot of kind of energy exposure among your top five holdings. How much of an issue then is kind of the state of commodity prices? And do you worry about the trust essentially becoming too geared into that kind of dynamic?
Yes, we would. We've got just under 20% of the trust in energy companies at the moment. This might surprise you, but this is not a call on the energy price. So we are not forecasting that energy prices are going to go up. So what we tend to do is we will tend to sort of use the same sort of energy price that the companies themselves use. So the companies themselves, when they're budgeting, they use about $70 Brent. The price of Brent today is $90, so significantly above that. The interesting part of this thesis is that ordinarily when oil prices are that high and therefore the companies are very profitable and they throw off a lot of cash, what normally happens is that they begin to overinvest, don't they? And that eventually that sows the seeds of the downturn in the cycle, because all that supply goes in, eventually supply picks up and you know, therefore commodity prices go down. At the moment, that's not happening, because these companies are under enormous pressure politically not to invest in obviously in fossil fuels. And therefore, what we're seeing is commodity prices going up, and yet the normal functioning of the capital cycle is being circumvented. So CapEx is not going up. CapEx of the large oil companies today is about half the level that it was 10 years ago. Just incredible. And therefore, one can see how energy prices will remain high, because there just isn't enough investment going in today, and yet demand continues to be really robust. You know, demand, oil demand this year will be a record high, despite some forecasts to the contrary. So those companies are throwing off loads and loads of cash, and as I say, doing the right things with that cash, buying back stock, paying dividends.
Mm. And on banks, you know, I have to ask the kind of classic questions. How do you kind of balance the benefits, or how do you think they'll balance the benefits of kind of higher rates versus the risk that those rates cause more loan problems and balance sheet problems and so on?
Yeah, that's exactly the right question to ask. I think the first thing to say is that some fund managers have a tendency to fight the last war, by which I mean, I think some people were so scarred during the financial crisis. You know, I've read people who literally will say, I will never invest in a bank again. That always puzzles us, because we think, what, three times earnings, two times earnings, one times earnings, you'll never invest in a bank. So that kind of slightly puzzles us. And one has to recognize that these banks have significantly improved their capital ratios since then, not just the capital ratios. So obviously the balance sheet strength is much better, but the loan book itself as well is significantly better. Mm. And therefore, You're absolutely right. If we go into a if we go into a nasty recession, one would expect that the defaults will pick up to a certain extent. But I would argue that that you know, the companies are being priced like that at the moment. A lot of these things are trading on, you know, sort of half book at a time that they're generating returns on equity, double digit returns on equities. So for some reason, the market is making the assumption that already that, you know, that their earnings are going to go down. And you're absolutely right. At the moment, they are getting the benefit of higher rates, aren't they? We're seeing net interest margins go up without so far a big pickup in defaults. So and as I say, that, you know, the market is appears to be pricing in something significantly worse than we're seeing today.
Mm-hmm.
You can now get 12 weeks of an Investor's Chronicle print and digital subscription for just £12. You'll get instant access to our website and our app, plus the magazine delivered to your door every week. Check the terms and conditions in the show notes for more information.
Sticking with pricing, you know, we've already discussed the, I suppose, valuation of the UK market quite broadly versus, you know, comparators. But I am slightly puzzled because the trust only appears to have, I think at the last count, something like 72.8% allocated to kind of UK listed stocks. If you're so bullish, why not more? What's the story there?
Good question. So there are normally two reasons when we invest in overseas stocks. The first one is when you just simply cannot get access to a particular sector via the UK. So an example of that would be autos. There just really aren't any quoted UK auto companies anymore, bar Aston Martin. And so we have a holding in Stellantis, which is a European car company, which we think is very cheap. So that would be one reason. The second reason is to lower stock-specific risk. So we've just been discussing the energy sector. Let's say we want to put 20% of the trust into the energy sector. If we just stuck to UK companies, broadly speaking, that would mean having 10% in BP and 10% in Shell. And that is probably too much stock-specific risk. So we would argue it makes sense to have smaller holdings in those companies and then access the sector via ownership of some of the overseas companies. So, for instance, on the trust we own Total, because you're getting the exposure to the sector, but you're lowering your stock specific risk. And let's be honest, they're not really UK companies, are they? They're global companies. They all have very similar exposure, both geographically and across their businesses. So those really are the two reasons why we invest overseas.
And how much is too much in terms of position size? So I know, for example, you know, Shell is something around 7%. BP, yep. 6.5%. That's still relatively punchy.
It is. That's normally about the max that we go to. But I would say that myself and Nick Purvis, who I co-manage the fund with, we have always run concentrated portfolios. We're not believers in having huge numbers of holdings that effectively just you end up being an index hugger, don't you? If you have large numbers of holdings, we think if people are going to pay a fee for active management, they should get active management. And we believe active management is running with a concentrated portfolio and basically having significant allocations to the your highest conviction ideas.
Interesting. I suppose kind of looking more broadly at the fund's characteristics, and perhaps this is something that might set you apart from peers at the minute. I was looking at your kind of share price dividend yields, and at the time of recording, it's around 3.9%, which might be, I suppose, kind of in line with the market or in line with the FTSE 100, but perhaps lower than some peers. Are you kind of happy with that kind of broad level? And how is your approach kind of working out in terms of prioritizing income versus more of a total return kind of outlook?
So there's a balance here to be had with the trust. Lots of the investors in the trust, they do want an income. Nick and I have always been total return investors, so we will never go and buy something that we think is, you know, so-so valuation just to get a bit of yield. We're just not interested in doing that. you know, we have to, I suppose we have to balance the requirements, don't we, of delivering a reasonable level of income. And I think we do deliver a reasonable level of income. The dividend on the trust went down during the pandemic and has been basically recovering since then. In some respects, actually, we're victims of our own success in that clearly when the share price goes up, the yield goes down. And actually, just recently, you know, lots of the share prices have gone up, and therefore the yields on them have gone down. But it's a balancing act for us. We think that over time you can probably do both things. You can buy undervalued businesses, and you can also provide people with a good yield, and you can grow that income over time.
And to what extent do you hold things that don't really pay much out? I mean, I know, for example, Marks and Spencer is in the portfolio. And some managers make the case for, I suppose, actually using dividend cuts as a kind of interesting contrarian buy or turnaround opportunity type thing.
So there have been times in our investing career that we have bought companies which are not paying any dividend at that point in time because we think that they are very significantly undervalued. So financial crisis was one of those periods. You know, lots of the banks, house builders, insurance companies, et cetera, obviously had to cancel their dividends. And we bought lots of those. And so the income went down at the time. But as we came out of the financial crisis, people were more than rewarded and by the capital gain that they got. Similar sort of thing happened during the pandemic. You know, bought lots of companies there which had reduced or passed their dividends during the pandemic. But that income came back very, very quickly. But we think there's always room in the portfolio for companies where we think there's very significant upside and they're not currently paying a dividend. So we don't have any rule that says everything in the portfolio needs to yield more than the index or anything like that. It's a balancing act. You know, we've got some stocks in there, you know, the energy companies, the banks, et cetera, which are giving you a very high dividend yield. Mm. And then against that, as you say, you balance that with the Marks and Spencers and the IDSs and so on and so forth, which have got a lower yield, but potentially a greater capital gain.
Mm. So you mentioned IDS, and I should note that this is just at a time of recording, what's happened, and things could move on in the kind of intervening days and weeks.
Yes.
But, you know, at the time of recording, we've had some interesting news of kind of the largest shareholder thinking of kind of doing a bid for IDS. And we've also seen other interesting things to consider about whether Royal Mail should go down to 4 days a week and so. But I'd just like to get your kind of outlook on the stock and what's going on with it at the time.
Yeah. Okay. So often what people don't realise about IDS, you know, there was a reason that they changed their name from Royal Mail to IDS. And that reason is that there are two bits to IDS. There's a European logistics business called GLS. So all they do is deliver parcels. And I guess, as we all know, because we all sort of tend to do lots of our shopping online, don't we? That, you know, parcels delivery is a business which is in secular growth at the moment. So that business, we think, is a good business. And we think actually the valuation of that business is worth more than the entire market cap of IDS at the moment, just that one bit. Then you've got the letters business. And the letters business, or sorry, the UK business, is going through a transition. So, most of us would realise, wouldn't we, you know, probably years since most of us have sent a letter. So letter volumes just continue to go down and down and down every year. And the business, to a certain extent, is structured for the old world. It's structured for the world in which we were all sending letters lots of the time. And what the management team are trying to do is basically transition that business from a letters business into will always have an element of letter delivery, but basically into a sort of logistics business, so a parcels delivery business. And at the moment, that means the UK business is loss-making. As they try to go through that transition, they try to sort of restructure and you know, make the business more efficient. But we think in the fullness of time, there is potentially a lot of value if the management team get that right, if they manage to turn it around. The company has a very strong market position in the UK. And I suspect that is probably what their largest shareholder, I suspect that is probably the view that he is taking at the moment. And he probably thinks that the current share price doesn't reflect the potential if they get that that turnaround correct.
Mm. Speaking of turnarounds, then, what's your? I mean, everything here will be pretty idiosyncratic, but what would generally make you sort of give up hope and throw in the towel on a turnaround play?
Normally, when you're buying a turnaround, what you're saying is effectively that the company or the industry is experiencing a temporary or a cyclical problem that has taken earnings down, and that shareholders have focused too much on that downturn in earnings, and they are basically pricing that business as if it's not going to recover. And effectively, you're saying we think it is going to recover, and you're valuing it off the recovered earnings. And you know, hopefully, most of the time that kind of works. Yeah, you have to be contrarian, you have to be long term. But then there are occasions when that does not work. So you think that there's been a sort of a temporary downturn, and it subsequently turns out that it wasn't actually, that this is a business which is in structural decline. And so you're effectively betting on a mean reversion upwards of earnings. And what happens is the earnings just continue to go down. And effectively what you've bought is a business where the intrinsic value of the business is just fading over time. And so the share price will just continue to follow that down. Those are really, really hard because, you know, of course, I'm speaking to a certain extent with the benefit of hindsight. Making that call at that point of time is a really hard one, to say, no, this is definitely a structural decline. And of course, by the time you can see that, lots of other people can probably also see that. And therefore, it probably has been reflected in the share price. But by and large, that's when we will put our hands up and admit that we've made a mistake.
Mm. One other interesting sort of turnaround, I guess you could call it a turnaround story that has cropped up in recent weeks is Vodafone. And again, this is, I suppose, an example of a dividend cut and some kind of shifts of priorities and so on. Do you and Nick kind of have a take on that stock?
Yes. I mean, we think it's clearly held on the portfolio. We think it's undervalued. And, you know, as you quite rightly say, there's been a change of management, a change of strategy, more of a focus on realizing value. So basically selling some assets to try to realize value. It's not a stock that we've added to a lot, I have to say. And the reason for that is that we are cognizant of the fact that it's a very tough industry. You know, it is a very, very competitive industry. It's an industry where we as consumers have benefited from it over time, haven't we? Because, you know, we've got faster and faster data, more and more bandwidth for lower and lower prices, whereas the poor old shareholder hasn't really felt the benefits. So, you know, it's one where we think it is probably an undervalued situation. Current management team is doing their best to try to demonstrate that, but it is definitely a tough industry.
And are there any other sectors where you would generally be a bit more cautious and where you think there's perhaps, it's a bit harder to be optimistic, I suppose?
I think an interesting one is tobaccos. So lots of income funds will have tobacco companies in their top 10. Mm. And you can sort of see why, can't you? Because cosmetically, they appear to offer low price earnings ratios, high dividend yields, and you know what's not to like about that. We think that the current level of earnings are unsustainable. The tobacco companies went through this sort of fabulous period in which they were able to offset declining volumes by putting prices up, so they managed to eke out a little bit of sales growth. Then they sort of took out costs, they generate cash, they bought back stock. And there was this fabulous period from sort of 2000 to 2015. So share price of British American Tobacco went from roughly £3 to £50, believe it or not. Mm. So 20-odd% total return per annum on a sales base only growing at 2% per annum. We just think it's all happened now. So, and we think the dynamics now are going in the opposite direction. So now the price increases are not offsetting the volume declines anymore. So your sales is flatlining. You've probably taken out all the costs you can take out. So you've got very high margins of 40-odd%. So that probably isn't going to go any further up. If anything, it's going to go down. They are trying to invest in their next generation products. So they're vaping and so on and so forth. At the moment, that's loss making. So that's putting pressure on margins. So We think that's one where, you know, today's level of earnings and dividends are potentially not sustainable. And that might be a sort of, I suppose, a classic example of what people call a value trap, where, you know, cosmetically it looks like you've got cheap PE and a high dividend yields, but it's a value trap because both the earnings and the dividends are unsustainable.
You've reminded me, 2 or 3 years ago, you did make the case for energy stocks being, as you put it, the new tobacco, in that they were kind of, you know, people had put too much bad news into the share price and so on.
Yes.
Is there anything else, any other sector now that has struck you as that kind of having that kind of appeal?
Well, I suppose it's the ones we were discussing a few minutes ago. So it's the financials. To a certain extent, maybe mining would be another example. So another industry which is, you know, throwing off an awful lot of cash at the moment. Valuations are very low. You know, they have the ability to pay you back dividends and buy back their stock at very low valuations. So yeah, that would be another example. I think people underestimate the power of share buybacks. I think people maybe look far too much for high top line growth, high sales growth, and they probably overpay for high sales growth, and they underestimate the potential returns that you can get when companies are lowly valued and basically just buy back a lot of stock at those low valuations. So that the example I was using 2 minutes ago, BAT going from £3 to £50, you know, that was to a certain extent because of the factors we were talking about, but a large element of that was share buybacks and dividends. And I think people often underestimate how powerful those can be.
Yes, and perhaps, I suppose, in the fullness of time, we'll see the effects of that.
Yeah.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Well, that's all very interesting stuff, but I'm afraid that is all we have time for. So, Ian, I'd just like to thank you for coming on. I'd like to thank our very talented Maddie Apthorpe, our producer, as always. And thank you to everyone for listening.
Thank you very much.